Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We got the new gear out from our friends at Strategic Factory. Big shout out to Keith Miller. I want to get everybody into the holiday season here. I've been crushing these Taharka Brothers ice creams. They're all empty. There's some residue here of the sweet potato crumble that sort of got left over there. I'm surprised I didn't lick that off like a cookie dough. But please order it. Take your $15.70 off the order at Taharka upon checkout. Put the Baltimore Positive code in, and we'll make that happen. So you'll be into eggnog and peppermint bark and all the other good stuff for the holidays. I'll tell you what, it's been a weird week here. I reached to John Eisberg a couple weeks ago. We were chatting about Ravens and where the season was going and COVID and all those things. And then I book him on to talk about Greg Montgomery, and lo and behold, Eisenberg, you and Luke and Sandusky, everybody's gonna have to rewrite all the 25 greatest regular every, you know, all that stuff. Monday night was one for the ages, and you know, I canceled my flight from going nowhere. On Sunday morning, I canceled my flight to Cleveland. I was sort of hanging in and thinking, can I get the cat sat for? Am I going to go out there? And the COVID thing, and I realized it wasn't going to be an empty stadium. I realized it was going to be a good football game. I didn't realize like I was going to like unpunch my ticket for an instant classic. I'm a little embarrassed that I've spent 22 trips to Cleveland never seeing anything worthwhile other than a Springsteen Obama event about 12 years ago. But Monday night was pretty special, huh?
Very special. I mean, it is true. It's funny. I've been to Cleveland 1,000 times. And, you know, those fans out there, I think they've been clinically depressed for years. I mean, you know, you walk into that stadium and those poor fans have just...
You feel the weight, don't you? Like, literally, you and I have been in that press box for 20 straight years looking out. Same people sit in front of us. They have a Tim Couch jersey. They've ripped the name off. We've seen it all out there.
And the whole ethos is, all right, what's going to happen today? I mean, it's just awful. And so finally they have a good team, and they are a good team. They have a good team that's headed in the right direction. I mean, you could obviously see that on Monday night and see that before that this year. And where did I hear? Someone said that the end of that game, that is always what happens to the Browns. You know, going back to Ernest Biner, for crying out loud, you know, that is always what happens to the Browns. Oh, the fumble or something.
Were you at the drive game?
I was at the drive game. I was on the field for
I was
drive.
At the drive game in section 10, which was sort of right field. Ernie Accorsi got me a ticket. I flew out there with Phil Jackman on a 6:05 a.m. flight.
I think I was
United.
On
you were on the flight with us?
I flew out that Sunday morning. I flew out.
We flew out. We got on the RTA. We RTA'd into Tower City. We came up, there were Minifield, Dixon, jerseys, yep. Dog masks. Jackman and I walked across the square to the church. You know, the church, incredibly, like, it looks like it's right out of, like, Cologne or something, you know? And, you know, Jackman's like, we're going to church. And so into the church we go. They're wearing masks in there. Everybody's got COSAR jerseys, the whole, like, I have such vivid memories. John, you were there the day that I met Kevin Byrne was the day the Bengals came and closed the stadium down and they ripped the benches out. You were there that day too, right?
I was. I was there.
So, I mean, we've seen everything. I mean, to have witnessed that, myself, yourself, ourselves, and then to be sort of trapped in the middle of a plague on a Monday night, they're finally good. They can finally, I mean, I got Art Modell sitting back here on the dais, you know, like they can finally like do us dirty. And then, Willis Reed shows up, man.
Yeah. Just crazy. Absolutely crazy. I mean, I'm watching this stuff and, you know, I feel like I've seen just about everything, but that was new. That was new, running out of the locker room. Great stuff. I mean, Lamar Jackson, it's been fun to have him here. And I think Baltimore is lucky, in some respects. Certainly, the Ravens have been repaid already in being bold enough to take him, to draft him, and sort of the counterintuitive thinking in the NFL and to build an offense around him. A unique quarterback. And so, on a night like that, it just really shows, to their, they were the ones that took the gamble, but how fortunate it is that it's worked out this well, because he is a really special player, and it's just fun to watch.
John Eisenberg is here. You can find him at BaltimoreRavens.com. You can find him out on the interweb. This is a great time to tell you that John, I'm always telling people to shop local and buy local and get local ice cream and Royal Farms and all my great spot. Pizza John's, Planet Fitness, all local people here involved in that brand. You know, local authors and your book, and you wrote a book on the league. You got books on Cal Ripken. You got books on horses. You got books on the Dallas football traditions and the Green Bay Packers and all sorts of things. But this is a time where, you know, gift giving. I want to give you a little platform to talk about books, and then we're going to go back and talk about Lamar Jackson.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's 'tis the season, and my most recent book is the one on the creation story of the NFL. Centered around some of the original owners, including Art Rooney in Pittsburgh. It's called The League. And I must say, I'm sort of dumbfounded by this book. Came out in 2018 in hardback, paperback in 2019. And if you click on Amazon today and look at it, it is a bestseller in a bunch of categories. So an evergreen subject. People love hearing about the early days of the NFL. And so great stuff. That one, The League, is going well. I wrote the book about Ripken's streak. It's called The Streak. That came out in 2017. It was it was one of the top 10 sports books of the year, according to ESPN that year. So lots of stuff. You can actually go to my website, johneisenberg.com, and there's 10 books laid out there. And they're all selling a little bit this Christmas. So I'm a big believer in that. You want to thinking about what to give somebody. Give them a book. It doesn't have to be mine, but a book is always a great gift.
You know, you were talking about the history of the league, and I have a piece here that John Stedman gave me. I mean, early days of the Evening Sun when we had left the News American. He brought this in. He knew how much I love football and the Oilers. It's my 29th anniversary on Sunday of doing radio, John, and you and I were colleagues back in the day. I just want to show this to you because I think it's the first thing that was ever printed that said the word Super Bowl on it. Yeah. So I want you to look at the date. That is really Super Bowl I, right? But it was never called the Super Bowl until 3 on any of the tickets. I think this was Pete Rozelle's first ever printed item that used the word Super Bowl. And it's a press kit from the actual game. And
John was there.
This is Stedman stuff. He left. He gave it to me, right? So so this is the flip card from the game. With all of his handwriting, if I show you, this is all John's handwriting in it about notes and all the things. And apparently at halftime, the coaches made themselves available. and like literally, Stedman has handwritten notes here that say Lombardi said at halftime, right?
Wow.
No. I'm showing you. This is crazy, crazy stuff. That's why when you're talking about the history of the league, and this is an arm's reach away, I didn't mean to hijack you, but this is just sitting behind me in my office because I was going through stuff. This is the steno of the post-game notes, and like it's an incredible treasure trove. People love the history of the league, right? Like and I think for your book and for some nerd like me that's kept this stuff around all these years, and it probably has, you know, incredible value, this little package. I've taken it to the Football Hall of Fame, and I've said, you know, do you guys want this? What I want to know, I want it verified as the first thing that ever said Super Bowl on it. Because this was handed out in the press box at the AFL-NFL championship game.
Yeah.
Tell me about, like, from your book and the perspective of all of that, because the way we perceive the NFL to be, there's so many things that went into making it, like the fact that we sit and watch it in the middle of a plague, and they play it in the middle of a plague.
Well, my book is really about the early days for many, many years, it was not that. For many, many years, the professional football in this country was a second-tier sport, way behind baseball and behind other sports like boxing and horse racing and, college football, way behind college football. And the reason I wrote the book, I ran into, I had a publisher, and they said, oh, I want to do an early book on the early history of the NFL. I said, okay, great. And he goes, okay, what's the story? And so it took me a while to figure it out. The story really is, I thought, the owners I mean, who survived these early years when the NFL wasn't making any money, when no one was coming to the games. And this is like three decades of it. And how did they get through those years and then set themselves up to take off in the 50s when the television lights came on and Johnny Unitas showed up and suddenly it was this great sport? How did they get through those years? So I zeroed in on five guys. And, you know, Stedman knew those. Stedman was a big fan of Burt Bell's, and he well should have been. Burt Bell, who started the Eagles and ultimately became commissioner of the NFL, he's the reason the Colts came to Baltimore. Burt Bell was determined to have a football team in Baltimore. And so you got that guy. And then, of course, George Halas, who was pro football for 60
Why
years.
Baltimore? I mean, I guess because of Annapolis and the fact that it was working class. There was no thought that the Orioles really worked, right? I mean, at that point. So, like, what made Baltimore ripe?
Well, football, I mean, the Colts came before the Orioles. And so they did have a stadium. And, you know, Burt Bell, really what it was Carol Rosenblum, Burt had coached him at Penn. Okay. Carol, went to Penn and played halfback. I don't know how well he played, but Burt, had been a really good player at Penn and then was a coach. He was a rich kid. He was just kind of knocking around and he was coaching some football. And so he liked Carol, and then Carol gets out of Penn and becomes extremely successful businessman. And I was looking for a team. And I think Burt and Carol was like, hey, I'm ready to get in. And they were looking for good owners.
Sportsmen.
Yeah, sportsmen. This was sportsmen. The early 50s when franchises are moving around. I mean, it wasn't like today where there are all these sort of iconic institutions. Franchises were moving around a lot. And so, hey.
And building Jim Brown and Art Modell in a place like Cleveland was 50 years later, 60 years later, we look at that and say, yeah, you know, whatever. They're still trying to do that in Arizona and Tampa and a whole bunch of places, you know, literally, right?
Very true. And it's what people, I think Ravens fans don't realize is what they're up against the Ravens. And the Ravens, extremely successful franchise on and off the field and obviously going in the right direction and will get where they want to go. However, it's tough when you're a new franchise. You only have, what, 25 years of history, and it's great history. But when you're facing like the Redskins, you know, the former Redskins, you know, 80 years.
But you know what, man? Yesterday's brands don't matter anymore. Like, listen, all week long, I'm talking to Jacksonville people and I can't help but be an ass because I was sitting at the bar at Bo Hager's with a bottle of champagne when they said Jacksonville.
I was standing next to William Donald Schaefer in Chicago, standing next to him when that happened. And
he cried, right?
He absolutely cried. And I was the one that wrote it that said, because, I was standing right there and he just starts crying. And so, it is true. The old brands don't matter as much, but they do. The Green Bay Packers, the Pittsburgh Steelers, the Dallas Cowboys.
But you can murder your brand.
Yeah.
The Redskins, the Orioles. I mean, we've presided over two brands being murdered in our presence. You wrote a book on a brand that's been murdered. You can't sell Oriole history books now because the last 25 years, they've screwed up the entire franchise, John.
Well, yes. And the Ravens are doing it right. And as I said, they are going to do it right. But I'm telling you, you're up against it when you're just in terms of fan size of your fan base, revenue, lots of things. And so, you know, Baltimore is not an obvious market. And so they've done it right. And it's a rewarding thing for the fans here. But it's not easy. It is not easy.
Well, look at the Lions. I mean, and then look at the Seahawks. The Seahawks were a nothing brand. And now the entire Northwest quadrant of the country is big, weird green, your Dayglo green, you know?
Yeah, it takes off. It takes off. It does. But you better keep doing it. You better keep doing it.
But winning matters. And, you know, and this team now has some excitement. John Eisenberg is here. I didn't mean to, like, take you down the Burt Bell thing. Upton Bell shared the image of the certificate that signed the league in when Rosenblum bought the team on Twitter, like, yesterday. So it's kind of weird we're talking about that. I want to go back to this team and Lamar and, you know, the notion that Monday can be the beginning of a special ride, right? John, I see the next 3 weeks as like mandatory victories, right? And I don't know, mandatory style points. They don't need to go out and beat anybody like a drum. I mean, I don't want them winning by field goals against the Bengals hanging on for their playoff lives 3 weeks from now. But I fully expect one of these three games to be frightening in the fourth quarter because that's the way the league is. I'm trying to figure out if this is a preseason that leads up to January 9th and 10th, because I see what's ahead. They're going to have to get on a plane and go to Buffalo or Kansas City or Pittsburgh or whatever remnants are left of those. And they're going to have to win, and they're going to be judged by that. And Monday night was nice, and it feels good in a season where there haven't been a whole lot of highlights around here from the way it was last year. Can they build this thing? Can they beat these three bad teams up and put this thing and get healthy enough with their really good players? What's Calais Campbell and Brandon Williams and Marlon Humphrey, Matt Judon? Tell me what their health is on the 9th and 10th after winning three games, and what this offensive line will become, and whether Hollywood Brown stops dropping passes and whatnot. But they need to win that game, and there's nothing else now that they're in a position to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think they'll get there. I don't think they're going to fumble the ball, so to speak, in these next 3 weeks. I agree with you. There'll be a tough one in there. Could be the Giants here. Giants have a decent defense. I don't think it'll be the Jaguars on Sunday. They lost 12 games in a row. The season finale in Cincinnati, I've been at some of those where they don't turn out right. I do think the Ravens will win these three games, and that will get them into the playoffs. And I think going on the road is no problem for this team. I honestly think it may be better for them. The last couple of years, set up at home, everything going for you.
Take a week off, right?
Yeah. It's not worked out. You know, the press spotlight on them. All right. It really is. And I'm sort of, can't believe I'm saying this, but I think it is true about this team. Sort of give them a challenge, you know, ignore them, tell them they got to go on the road, make it harder, supposedly. And I think you get their best game. I do think you get their best. They're certainly not bothered at all by going on the road and playing, and stack a few things against them, and I think you get a better performance, less pressure. They don't seem to really like, you know, the number that certainly didn't work last year. So I don't think it's a problem. Now, winning three games in a row on the road to do that, that is tough, and they'll have to do it. So we'll see. But I do think they'll get into the playoffs, and I think they'll be a dangerous team.
John Eisenberg joining us here from Ravens.com, where he pods and casts and writes and opines, and you can find him out on social media, and sometimes banging around the Stoneley as well, near the Royal Farms there. The Greg Montgomery story, I'll just temper this by giving a little introduction on my behalf. I met Greg Montgomery in the locker room of the Pontiac Silverdome in 1993, the summer of 1993. My beer buddies and I went on a bender driving from Baltimore to Detroit. We went to Tiger Stadium. We saw the Oilers play, my Oilers play a very, very August 9th preseason game at the Pontiac Silverdome with 12,000 friends, where you got blown into the blimp and blown out of the blimp if you ever walked into any of those blimpified stadia. And I had my little recorder, and I was getting Houston Oilers. And John, you can appreciate this because you knew Little Nasty Nestor in 1992-93. I had my tape recorder that was a piece of crud, and I carried it into the locker room, and I had about 15 Houston Oilers. Chip Namius gave me a press pass, and I told him I did radio in Baltimore. And Ernest Givens, Haywood Jeffries, Warren Moon, Mike Munchak, I'm just trying to get Bruce Matthews. They were all on the team. And Greg Montgomery was the punter. And this was right in the era. Maybe they were 6 months out from losing that famous game up in Buffalo. It was that team, right? So they all did bumpers for me. Jack Pardee was the coach. He did a bumper for me. The coordinator that Buddy Ryan punched, what was his name? He became Gilbride. He did a bumper for me. He actually came on the show. Bubba McDowell was a coach. So I'm giving you a little background, but I walk up to Montgomery, and Montgomery did a bumper, and I have to find it. Hey, this is Greg Montgomery of the Houston Oilers. You're listening to Budweiser Sports Forum with Nasty Nestor Apparee. All right, 3 years later, he's here. And I'm out in Owings Mills and sort of remember, and he was completely hippified. You know what I mean? Like black fingernail polish, tats, loved metal music. He and Steve Everett loved music. They did a 98 rock show together after they came out to the barn and did a thing with me. And I called him Monty. And after he left, he would call me when he would come to town. And he would literally call, hey, Ness, it's Monty. I want to come out to the studio today. And he would come out to the studio, and he was really sober and doing well most of the time when I saw him. I mean, I never saw him in any sort of distress. He would come in and tell me how his life was going. He'd kick his feet up, tell me about his bar in Houston, tell me about vitamins he was doing and this and that. And but I knew he was a complex person. And I knew he had highs and lows. But he never reached to me on the lows. I always, and it wasn't euphoria high. It was just sort of like, I'm glad he's doing well, because I knew he, like many players that you and I have encountered, have some demons, right? So I want you to pick Storm, because I don't really, I just know 15 teammates reached to me at some point late in the summer and told me the bad things that happened to Monty, and a couple of really, you know, people that he worked with intimately, still waiting to get a story. And Matt Stover reached to me 2 weeks ago, and I said, you know what? Eisenberg has put on his Pulitzer Prize journalism hat to do this justice. So I want to leave it for you, but that's all I know, and I want you to pick it up, other than a tweet from a college friend that said that he had passed.
Yes. Well, the reason we're talking about it is I do this podcast for the Ravens. I've just finishing up the second year. It's called What Happened to That Guy? You can get it where it's on the Ravens Podcast Network. It's on their website. It's on the app. It's on Apple, you know, wherever you get a podcast.
The Kyle Bowler is my favorite, by the way, but go ahead.
So, well, this one may be my favorite. I mean, it's a tough story, but so I did an episode on Greg Montgomery, and actually I did two episodes. The first one dropped last Tuesday. The second, part two, will drop next Tuesday. And the reason I did two episodes was I found out what had happened to him. And yes, as you described, he was a fascinating, interesting, fun guy with a bunch of interest. He did have demons. His demons was some mental illness. I mean, he had bipolar disorder, severe depression, anxiety, and, you know, he committed suicide, this summer, late summer in August. And so, that once I found out that, I wasn't sure I wanted to do the story. Then I saw online what was happening, and his family has started a foundation in his name to destigmatize mental illness and to bring awareness, just bring awareness to it, and to raise money and to help people. And I thought, you know, I need to tell this story. That one got me. I said that the first story is, the first episode is his life and times. The second episode is what is going on in the aftermath of his death. And I reached out. I saw online a sister, younger sister, is the one really driving this foundation. I called her up. I interviewed her. She's just unbelievable, talking about her brother and the brother she idolized, who was a complete stud athlete, you know, was an All-American at Michigan State. The punter, drafted number 72 overall by the Oilers, third-round pick, one of the highest draft picks ever, just a complete stud, had a nice career, not a great one, but a very solid career. So I wound up interviewing Stover about him. I interviewed Sean Landetta about him. They were colleagues and friends. Talked to Kevin Byrne, and I talked to his wife. I mean, I'm sorry, not his wife. I talked to his sister, Greg's sister. So I had a lot of material, and wound up putting it in two episodes. And this is a guy that, when he was with the Ravens, at the end of his career, is the first time he was diagnosed being bipolar. Until then, he was pretty much on his own, figuring out these highs and lows and, you know, just stuff that was just blowing him away. You know, I won't give away the story, but I will tell you, I mean, there were interviews, and you can find them. I found it, interviews, and NFL Films did a documentary on him. You know, he contemplated suicide with the Ravens during training camp in the summer of 1997. He was having a terrible low. There was an exhibition game in Philadelphia. He drops back to punt. He has no idea what he's doing back there. He's having a panic attack. He doesn't know that he's supposed to kick the ball. And that is harrowing. I've never heard an NFL player say that. Very harrowing, chilling stuff. And so I just ran with it. And the first podcast episode, as I said, dropped last week. The next one will drop next week. You know, I would encourage people to find that founded Gregory Hugh Montgomery Jr. Foundation for Ultimate Growth. And, it's amazing what they're doing. They're raising significant money. His father, recently widowed, their mom died. That's part of what sent him into a spiral, that and COVID, you know, precipitating his death. But, you know, his father was an All-American, was you know, an excellent, was a quarterback at Michigan State, really, really good football player. Greg inherited all of his sports genes, and it's a can-do family that had just taken this on, and it's pretty inspiring. And you know, I'm pleased with how these episodes came out. The second one is in final production, and I would encourage Ravens fans to listen.
Well, I appreciate you for telling the story, because so many people reached to me, and there were, I mean, that era of Ravens players, I'm sort of their age, you know what I mean? We've stayed in touch through all of these years, and, you know, every Mike Flynn, and even people that were long forgotten, the Alex Bernsteins, who, you know, sort of developmental players who made it onto the fringe, those guys were in my life, and they were all wondering what happened. So for you to tell the story is a gift for anybody that ever knew and loved Greg, because Greg was a great guy. So
that,
yeah,
really comes out. It comes out, his sister. It's really amazing what he did in life.
Did you know him a little bit?
Nah, very little. I mean, I was around that team.
I had a different role, you know, during that period of time. And I have the gift of those relationships all these years later. You know what I mean?
Well, I guess I had no idea. I mean, I knew he would have been, because Scott Carcell was the first guy that mentioned to me, said, when I was doing this last year, he said, hey, you know, Montgomery would be a good one for you. He's an interesting guy.
True Michigan soul.
Yeah. And it's true. I didn't know that. And then I found out what had happened to him. And, you know, it's just, it became another kind of story. But, you know, he was an exceptional person. I had no idea. Scott said he's been sort of a punting guru. He became sort of a private tutor. He was working for years with Nick Saban, Alabama's punters, year after year. Best college football team, like, ever. Greg Montgomery's hand was on that.
He was Belichick and Saban's punter in 1995 when the team got off the plane, right? I mean.
No, he was not. He was not on the team in 95 in Cleveland. Kevin Byrne told me that story. The punter that in 95 in Cleveland was Tom Tupa. Tupa.
He was the quarterback.
Yes, he had signed with New England. And so they were looking for a punter, and Montgomery, he sat out 1995 because of a bout of depression. He thought his career was over. And then
I don't remember that. Man, this, your story's going to be great, man. I want everybody to go listen. I'm definitely going to be all in, man. How long are your pods? Give everybody a little time commitment on this.
Most of them are 25 minutes. I keep them short. This one's a little longer, 35, 37. It needs to be. And there's just too much good stuff. And the second one will be back about the normal length, about, you know, 25 minutes. I try not to keep them long. That's part of the deal.
Well, I loved him in the beginning because he was an Oiler, right? I mean, I was an Oiler fan, and this was a guy that I had been rooting for. And every time they punted, every time Warren Moon lost on third down, he comes out. So I'm looking forward to it.
Just blast the ball, by the way. You know, there was no mess over. It was laughing. It's like, you know, it wasn't a lot of subtlety. You know, he's this huge guy, looked like a linebacker, and he would just blast the ball as far as he could. You know, I think they were trying to teach him to keep it inside the 20 a little bit, here when he was playing here, because he just blasted the ball. It's pretty funny.
Well, we haven't had a lot of punters here. I mean, Kyle Richardson's still living up the street, married a Dundalk girl, and Cook's been here forever, right?
So right.
There haven't been a whole lot of those. John, I always appreciate the time and the visits. Go buy John Eisenberg's books. Go follow him out on Twitter and, of course, at Ravens.com as we gear up for Jacksonville, New York, and Cincinnati, hopefully on the way to the promised land. John, take care of yourself. Happy holidays, all right?
Same to you. Thank you very much for having me on.
John Eisenberg, always one of our favorites to have around. Go check out his podcast and the Where Are They Now or What Happened to That Guy series out at Ravens.com. Make sure you're ordering some ice cream from Taharka. Take your $15.70 off when you get your 8-pack delivered to your door. Even if you live in Stoneleigh, they'll deliver to any of the 21230s and the 21286s, wherever you happen to be. Deliver online or order online. Click on the little cart when the discount code comes up. Just put Baltimore Positive in. $30. 8 pints delivered to your door. You pick your flavors. We appreciate the support. It is our first promotion as the all-new WNST.net AM 1570. Towson, Baltimore, where we never stop talking Baltimore sports stories, some politics, some local business for sure, and, of course, Baltimore Positive.